Well, hello, my friends. You have gotten on the road to Springwood, Ohio, and you found us hitchhiking on the side of it.
Once again.
My name is Henrik Kuto, of course, joined by David DeNoyer.
Unfortunately here.
And we have a very... Jeez, you're really throwing the shade, Dave. We have a very special guest this week, and it's super exciting because I'm not going to lie, when we decided to do a Freddy's Nightmares podcast,
yeah,
I didn't know if anyone in the world other than you and I would be excited about it in any way, shape, or form. But it turns out we've had some people get pretty amped about
it. Yes, we have.
And today we're sitting down with Al Katz.
Yes, we are.
Writer of, well, so far, because we're 10 episodes into the series.
10 episodes in, yeah.
He wrote Freddy's Tricks and Treats.
Yes, season 1, episode 4.
Yes.
Hold one second.
Oh, dear. He realized the show he was on and he's running for it. I tried to warn you, Dave. Oh, man. So Al is showing
us.
I just
remembered I had this.
Wow. An original screenplay.
Wow.
From the episode.
That is cool.
Production. This is a production draft.
Yeah. And it has the original title of The Exhibitionist on it, too, I'm noticing.
Yeah.
That is
actual production draft. This is 1,000 years old. Here's the cover page.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool. That is so cool.
That's awesome. No, and sincerely, and that's kind of one of the other interesting things about Freddy's Nightmares has been that a lot of the information behind it has felt kind of ethereal. Like nobody has anything to say about it. There's not a lot of Wikipedia about it. There's not a lot on IMDb about it. So we've taken it upon ourselves to dig deep.
And everyone who made it took a vow of silence.
It's true.
Doesn't that suck?
Yeah. But it's interesting because like with most anthology shows, and you know a little bit about anthology television, we'll talk a little bit more about that.
I've been involved with a couple.
Yeah, just a few.
But like most anthology shows, you end up having an incredible amount of talent pass through because you have a high demand for actors, for writers, and directors.
Well, there are no standing sets, no regular actors, there's a house style. That's your franchise, you know, how you look. But yeah, the fun of an anthology is everybody gets to come in and play in your sandbox.
Definitely.
So Al, if you wouldn't mind dropping a little bit of the other anthology shows you've worked on, ones that are much less bemoaned than the one we're talking about today.
Well, there was Tales from the Crypt.
That was on like UPN or?
Yeah.
joined that, went aboard that season 3, and then 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we kind of made that show ours to a degree. I then went on to I spent 2 seasons as a co-executive producer on The Outer Limits.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Showtime.
Very cool.
Couple years doing sci-fi, and that was incredible fun. You know, my approach to Tales from the Crypt was, it wasn't so much horror as black comedy. Really, really, really black
comedy. Comedy.
Very pitch black, yes.
wicked fun. Was always what my goal was. And so when I was hired aboard The Outer Limits, I was kind of a radical change of pace for them, because I'm not a sci-fi guy, but they were looking to shake it up a bit. And Mark Stern at Trilogy and Sam Egan, who was the showrunner on the 2 seasons that I was on The Outer Limits, they were terrific. They gave me free rein to do things that just they didn't normally do. I did an episode called What Will the Neighbors Think? Mm-hmm. Starred Jane Addams, Helen Slater directed it. Not Slater, God, Helen Shaver. Helen Shaver, my dear friend Helen Shaver. And it was about... God, it had a modicum of sci-fi to it. A neurotic woman with all kinds of aches and pains, drives around in a wheelchair just because she thinks she should. She can walk.
Oh, wow. Fine.
Ends up in the basement of her apartment building one day, gets electrocuted, and suddenly she can hear everyone's thoughts.
That sounds cool.
That's really that sounds cool. Really yeah. Cool.
And so, you know, and she could visualize them. And so it was just off the wall, you know, what they allowed me to do. It was great fun. I did an episode. I wrote an episode with Naren Shankar, who's done a lot of CSI episodes. I think he's run a couple of their shows. And Naren, it's funny, we all, you know, sitting in a writer's room at Outer Limits, these were such smart people in that room. Naren quit medical school because he wanted to write TV instead. I mean, just a brilliant, brilliant guy. And the room was filled with really smart people. And we all agreed as we sat in the room early in the process that the stupidest thing one could ever venture to try to write is in essence, a time travel. Is a time loop because it's just fraught with peril.
Yeah.
You're always fighting the, well, yes, but if this happened, then this would have to happen. And this would then. And Naren approached me in the middle of that season. Even though we'd all had that conversation, he'd been toying with an idea and he decided I was the person that should write it with him. And so we got involved in writing a time loop episode, and Kevin Nealon was the lead actor in it. It was great fun to work with Kevin. But yeah, science fiction was incredible fun because got to work in territories I'd never gotten to play in before. Hey, space operas.
Oh, wow.
Spaceships.
Yeah.
Fun.
That would be fun.
Sky's the limit. Literally, well, the sky isn't the limit.
Yeah, not,
you can go
not,
into
not
space. Yeah. So, what had you done prior to scoring a writing gig on Freddy's Nightmares? What were you coming off of?
I had a couple of screenplays in development. And that was pretty much it. I had no TV. The thing that really worked in most of these cases, I was partnered with a guy named Gil Adler. And Gil and I were creative partners for a decade. In fact, Gil was one of the first people I met when I came to Los Angeles in 1985. I grew up in Baltimore. I went to school in New York. I went to Vassar. I was a drama major at Vassar. And I had a friend from high school who'd become an agent at William Morris. And at this point, I was living in New York. I thought I was going to go into the theater. Writing plays, theater. To me, L.A. was the stupidest place in the whole world. It was the land of the avocado head.
I mean, you know, you're not entirely wrong. So I
had a friend from high school. My friend Carl Yumpkins became an agent of William Morris in Los Angeles. And she said, you know, you should try writing a screenplay. And I'd been toying with the idea. So I wrote one, and she said, this is pretty good. You should come out and meet and greet people. And I thought, okay, what have I got to lose? Stupid place. Go there, I'll come back. And it was June 1985, and L.A. was very different than it is now. Really, really different. It was a lot less crowded, a lot less traffic. But it was really pretty. And, you know, I grew up in the East. So, you know, June in the East is warm, it's humid, and in New York, humid. The city already smells. You know, you walk around, it smells like piss half the place. Oh,
yeah, I used to work in New York City, and I noticed.
So, well, hey, L.A. is the desert.
Yeah.
It's dry. There is no humidity. And the weather was fantastic. It was, and the people were so nice to me. I'd written a script, and everyone liked it. Excuse me, I apologize. I highly recommend having as much smoke blown up your ass as possible. It's a very nice feeling.
I bet.
It was great. One day my Carl took me to a Hollywood opening, Thane Elmo's Fire.
Oh, wow.
And that was incredibly intoxicating.
I can imagine.
To rub elbows into share canapé trays with all those people, it was very intoxicating. My fourth day here, I didn't have any meetings. And someone suggested I take a drive through Topanga Canyon, which is within the city limits. It's, you know, these days it's very much part of the city, but then it was much more remote. Mm-hmm. And driving from the 101, the freeway, through the Santa Monica Mountains as they head toward the ocean. And as I got to Pacific Coast Freeway, Pacific Coast Highway, where the mountains literally plunge right into the ocean, it was done. I had given up on the East Coast. What was there for me? I completely sold my soul, and I was very next month, I moved out to the land of the avocado head. something about this place and this business, it just appealed. It appealed to me. One of the first producers I met in that first week when I was out here was Gil. And he, liked the script I had written, wanted to hear what else I was pitching, liked what I was pitching. And he found some money and next thing you know, we were working on a screenplay together that he was producing and I was writing, but we ended up working on a screenplay together, something about his life, a really interesting little thing. Nothing came of it, but we really liked the process of writing together. It was very natural and it was just great fun to do. Gil trained as really an accountant. He worked in the office of a guy named Sid Finger who did the books on all the Bond pictures.
Oh, wow.
Trying to keep the studios honest.
Good luck.
Gil's understanding is an accountant's understanding. As a producer, if you have a dollar to spend, don't spend a dollar one. You ain't got it.
Yeah.
But if you could do it for 99 cents, that's even better than doing it for a dollar, provided that the quality is exactly the same as a dollar.
Yeah.
And so, that's the goal. It's no good just saying no to solving the problem. No, you can't have any money. No, you solve it. That doesn't help anybody.
Yeah.
So part of the how you do it for 99 cents versus a dollar is that you get really creative with the storytelling.
Yeah.
It starts with the script. If you are a writer producer, then you always have control of the means. The wonderful thing about television versus the feature film world is that TV is all writer producer driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, the writer producer is the power. In TV, a director is just a traffic cop.
Sounds right. Yeah. Well, and that's kind of like, it's almost like improv. Being a good producer is a lot of yes and as well. Lots of like, keep it going. You don't want to ever be a dead end.
It's problem solving. It's constant creative problem solving. And if you can throw money at it, great. That's not necessarily the best answer for any problem. But it is taking everything that you know and applying it to the problem that's coming at you like a freight train.
Absolutely. So for those who are the uninitiated, so Gil Adler became basically the showrunner of Freddy's Nightmares.
He was the Well, boy, we didn't call anyone a showrunner back then. Gil was wasn't the production manager, but he was the producer.
He
was the responsible producer. He was the one who was the link between really physical production and the money. And he was the real producer.
Yeah, he was on, his name's on every single episode.
Yes, and there was someone who was responsible for the writer's room and those concepts. And so Gil was not the showrunner in the sense that we think of a showrunner now. Showrunners are responsible more than anything for the franchise.
Gotcha.
For what stories are we telling? How are we telling them? How are we breaking it all down? They're not responsible for the day-to-day how we get it done.
Yeah.
It's good if they know how, if they understand it, so that they don't,
that'd be nice.
They don't imagine things in their heads that production cannot possibly do. That doesn't help anybody. And it happens.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Freddy's was an unusual situation because of the way that it came about. When the idea first suddenly, it got its go-ahead, I think Lorimar was...
Yeah, Lorimar.
The writer's strike was on. It was 1987.
And there was
a writer's strike. And so the first six episodes were done during the writer's strike, and they were done non-union. Okay. Well, neither I nor Gil was in the Writers Guild at that point. So we were able to do the first six episodes. Now, they paid, they did not pay scale.
You know, imagine. Episodes.
They paid less than scale.
Huh.
And those episodes got written. And the one that Gil and I wrote, well, you know, it helps having a producer, as your writing partner. And so also I think we did a fairly good job on that script. And that was the first episode of Freddy's that was ever shot.
Oh, wow.
So the first episode was Freddy's Tricks and Treats was the first
Welcome
one shot?
Welcome to Springfield.
Welcome to Springfield.
Oh, Springwood.
Or Springwood, yeah.
Yeah, Springwood, sorry.
It's
Springwood.
We do the same thing on our show. We do all the time. Say Springfield all the time.
After the writer's strike ended, they didn't hire any of us who had written, you know, who had scabbed.
Yeah.
they hired Writers Guild people and paid them a full whack. That's just how it is. The trick to the Freddy's episodes, and there was a puzzle aspect to it. The way that the money envisioned it in their wildest dreams, each episode of Freddy's Nightmares would be, of course, an hour of TV. Yeah. But it would also be 2 half-hours that could be syndicated separately as 2 half-hours that might have nothing to do with each other. So they had to be standalone half-hours and a standalone hour. Each episode. So there was a puzzle to working out how to do that.
It's fascinating.
So you could come into the story in Act 3 and go, oh, that's the beginning of the story.
Yeah, that's one of the things we always mention. Yeah, sorry.
Then, now, did it ever get released in this way? I'm sure not. I'm sure this was an utterly masturbatory exercise. The second season of Freddy's, they decided that was too simple. And they had even greater delusions of grandeur. And they thought, hey, what if we could sell these things as 2-hour movies in Europe? Jeez. And so each episode now had to be a 2-hour, 2 separate hours, and 4 separate half-hours of story.
I gotta say, and I've heard that broken down once before when I was listening to your podcast, How Not to Make a Movie. You guys touched on that briefly, which, by the way, anybody who has not heard your podcast really needs to go and give it a listen.
Well, thank you so much.
It's very good.
It was, well, you know, the reason that we did the podcast is because of a fan group.
Yeah.
Because of Dads in the Crypt.
Yes. Yeah.
It's all their bloody fault.
Yeah.
You know, Jason Stein, you know, Dads from the Crypt, I love their concept. And when he contacted me, he said, you know, we're Dads from the Crypt. We review all the Crypt episodes and we give parenting advice. I thought that was so funny. I'll do whatever you want. I'll do whatever you want. And so they were, you know, reviewing an episode. They wanted to interview me about it. It's a great interview. And a couple days later, he said, you know, we're going to be we're going to review a Bordello of Blood and, you know, if you want to do another interview about that. And I said, Jason, the story of the making of Bordello of Blood is not one simple little half hour interview. Yeah. That is a podcast unto itself.
Light bulb.
And that's kind of how it happened. I'd written out the story of the making a couple of years before for a book I had written as part of a therapeutic process. I went, you know, if you look at my resume, there's a big fucking hole in it. Yeah. I vanished off the planet. I vanished for 2 decades. I went through a 2-decade-long writer's block and really deep, deep depression. Yeah, on 3 days before Christmas 2016, I came within literal inches of killing myself.
Yeah.
But hey, the good news, happy ending is I came out the other end semi-scathed, not entirely unscathed, but you know. I regained a passion for storytelling I didn't even have when I was doing it. And the podcast was really a big part of that. Well, I had written out the story, and when I showed it to Jason, it was 26 pages. The making of Bordello of Blood. He said, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
So I set out to do that podcast. The goal with the podcast is I've dealt with my demons. I had no access to grind. I know, you know, Bordello of Blood marked, in hindsight, as I look back at it, that was the end of my relationship with Gil. It was really the thing that killed it dead,
yeah,
for a lot of reasons. That's really, to a degree, what the podcast is about. Doing the podcast, I hadn't talked to Gil in 25 years. I had to get back in touch with him to do the podcast.
Yeah.
Talked once or twice, but it was not terribly comfortable. But I got him to agree to do the podcast. He was reluctant because it's not a pleasant story to tell. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, for all of you lot. But
yeah, exactly.
The limit was, it was like having a whole bunch of porcupines shoved up your ass. It was, you know, the thing, why Bordello was so awful is because Tales from the Crypt was so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And making Tales from the Crypt was a dream job. It was a dream to do. It was getting to do a fantasy series in terms of what you working with the most amazing people, like little feature films every week on based on material I loved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved, yeah, Tales from the Crypt when I was a little kid. I loved Bill Gaines's world. I loved Mad Magazine. And so this was a dream job, and God, we were working really every episode was a wonderful creative challenge, and working with a great creative team of people. We had great actors to work with, man. It was everything you could possibly want. And, you know, we got the because we were doing so well with them, we got a mandate to do three feature films. And, you know, Demon Knight, the first one that we did, is now, you know, some people think of it as a horror classic.
And yeah.
Yeah. We would be in that camp.
Absolutely.
That camp,
yeah. Absolutely. That's us. Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we were capable of producing something great. And the second Tales from the Crypt feature was supposed to be something else entirely. You know, Gil and I really, we saw the second feature as a way to branch out.
Yeah.
Because we didn't want to do a monster movie. Well, that was Demon Knight, and that was Tales from the Crypt. We wanted to do a psychological piece. You know, in my mind was Nick Rogue's Don't Look Now, which is
fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I aspired to. And so we had found the script called Till Tuesday. It's a psychological thriller. It takes place in New Orleans, and we had retitled it Dead Easy, and had really invested a lot more in the characters, and we changed it pretty significantly. And to us and the whole crew that were making it, our whole Crypt team, this was a chance to make a film. We were really, this was a project that we all believed in, and we were going to take this to the next level.
Yeah.
We spent weeks in New Orleans prepping this. We were 3 weeks from starting principal. The script wasn't even done. And Universal pulled the plug and said, nah, come home from New Orleans. You're not going to make that movie. You're going to do this other movie instead. It's called Bordello of Blood. We'd never heard of this thing.
Yeah.
Now, the reason that Universal pulled the plug on the one and wanted us to make this other thing sight unseen. Oh, and just because we're doing a different movie doesn't mean the schedule changed.
No, of course not. No. That's
now,
your problem.
Now
not
we're
theirs.
Going from a movie. We spent 6 months writing and 6 weeks, 8 weeks prepping. We just handed the script and told you start shooting in 3 weeks. This is no way to make a movie.
No.
I should make a podcast called that. But now you have to understand, why did Universal do this silly thing? It seems self-destructive and doomed to failure. Well, and about that time, there was a newfangled company called DreamWorks had just happened. And one of the, you know, the big guys from the Universal stable was no longer in the stable, Spielberg. He had his own company. And they began to make deals with talent around town to, you know, so that they could become a real player. And Universal was desperately afraid that among the people that Spielberg would pluck was Bob Zemeckis. Bob and Steven were very tight. Steven is Bob's mentor.
Steven's
Bob's mentor. And they went to Universal, approached Bob and said, Bob, what can we do to make you stay? And whatever else, I don't know what else was in that deal, but I know one thing was in that deal. They bought the first script that Bob Z and Bob Gale ever wrote when they were still students at USC Film School, called Bordello of Blood. It was just part of the deal. They bought it for $500,000. It was a way for Bob Z, a very loyal man, to put a couple of dollars in Bob Gale's pocket. Put a $250,000 in his pocket. That was all that Bob Z had in mind when he made that little piece of this much larger, okay, I'll stay at Universal deal. Well, Universal, if I look at it from their point of view, they just, they're going to eat $500,000? So they looked around for how do we not eat this? And they saw us. And we were about to start a horror movie. Hey, one of the executive producers, Bob Zemeckis. They spent, maybe $50,000 on Dead Easy. Nothing. Peanuts.
Yeah.
And so they thought, no, you'll do, it's a horror movie. It's got Bob Zemeckis' name on it. And Bob Z's and Bob Gale's name, Back to the Future. Their names are worth a lot more than my name or Gil's name or J.P. Kelly's name. So if I look at it from Universal's perspective, I understand sure, this decision. It's cold, it's heartless, it's counterproductive to everything that they theoretically do for a living, but it saved them $500,000.
Yeah.
We had no desire to make that movie whatsoever. That's the most remarkable thing about it. It is a movie that literally no one at any point wanted to make. It was a deal.
Yeah.
We were forced to answer a deal point in a memo somewhere. And so we had 3 weeks to rewrite a student script so as to make it professionally presentable. Because, Bob Gale and Bob Z are very, very talented men.
Yeah.
Hey, of course they are. But when you're film students, no, they weren't talented yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were just making a script.
Therein lies the problem. Now, Bob, when Bob sold the script to Universal, he had no intention they were going to make this. This was something that just happened. It was a ripple effect. And so his attitude, he didn't care about the script. He said, look, guys, do whatever you have to. He was, incredibly gracious. But, on the one hand, it's a little intimidating. What are you really going to do? And the second, more importantly, we had 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the only job in front of us. We had to cast the goddamn thing. We had to get our crew heads, everyone in all the department heads had to get on board. We had 3 weeks. We're formal prep now. And then there was another wild card. Joker came up. Joel always had an up and down relationship with the IA, the union that represented our crew. And sometimes the union was up and sometimes Joel was up. And this was kind of, the union was up. And so Joel's attitude was, fuck me, no, fuck you. They struck a TV movie we did for Fox called Weird World. It struck it and shut us down. And so they were in the ascendancy and Joel's attitude was, fuck me, no, fuck you. And instead of shooting Bordello in Los Angeles with our crew and, with our special effects team, as a fuck you, we took the movie out of Los Angeles, and the closest place where they make movies is Vancouver. And that's why we went to Vancouver. Now, we were shooting in New Orleans in June. That was the schedule. In July. Well, that didn't change. And so now, instead of shooting in the swamps, a very creepy environment, day and night, okay, you can work a little bit with that. It's this creepy environment.
Yeah.
We went to Vancouver to shoot our horror movie. Now, the funny thing about a horror movie is your stock and trade is night. You need plenty of night. When you go that far north at the height of summer, one thing there isn't a whole lot of is night.
Night.
That is fucking stupid. That is so fucking stupid. And then, one hand did not know what the other was doing. So while we were relocating to Vancouver to go fuck you, The climax was written to take place in a glass, in a crystal cathedral, like they have in crystal in Garden Grove here in Los Angeles. You know, a glass church. Well, we found a glass church there in Vancouver.
Of course.
Where the climax takes place. Well, hey, it doesn't get shootable dark until around about midnight. And then the first hint of sunlight appears in the northern sky around 2:30, quarter to three. So you get 3, maybe 4 hours of shootable dark.
Yeah.
In your glass building to shoot your climax. A normal film day is 12 to 13 hours.
Yeah.
We had 4 to get the work done. No, we had set ourselves up for failure in 1,000 different ways in making this movie. And again, we didn't want to make it. And because the first decision was so inorganic, everything that flowed from it, well, there's no organizing principle. We're not rallying around. Well, here's the story we've got to tell. And so everything else, there's nothing. Once we became a rather dispensable commodity in our executive, well, in some of our executive producers' minds, Joel took it upon himself to cast our leads.
Oh, jeez.
And, hey, he's Joel Silver. He's Joel Silver.
Thoroughly enjoyed his stories on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, by the way, what a experience.
He's got a track record of success bigger than mine.
Yeah.
Who are we to argue? But Joel, why did we cast Dennis Miller? I, to this day, we can't tell you. Not a clue. Not a clue why we cast Dennis Miller. Joel never told us. Maybe Dennis has naked pictures of Joel doing something with a duck. I don't know. No idea. We had $500,000 in the budget. When Joel made the offer to Dennis, Dennis did not want to do the movie. And he so didn't want to do the movie. He said, yeah, give me $1 million. I'll do it. Figuring no one in their right mind would pay him $1 million, which is $1 million more than he's ever been paid to be in a movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What suddenly made this guy a $1 million man? I don't know. We turned to Universal. There's a thing called breakage. You can appeal to the people with the money. We need breakage. Can you help us with some money off budget? They said, well, we don't give a fuck about Dennis Miller. He's nothing to us. He was nothing to us because our audience was there to see a horror movie. Dennis Miller did, it was SNL, but he was the Weekend Update guy. Yeah. And he was he had a show on HBO when we hired him. This is not his audience, and our audience were not the same. This was not synergistic. Universal didn't want him, was not interested in either. They gave us no breakage, and they said, no, take it out of your budget. $12 million movie. $500,000 off the budget to pay for an actor we didn't want hurt, because the place where we put all the money, hey, we're a horror movie. Special effects makeup. Where did the money come out of? Special effects makeup to pay for an actor. To this day, I couldn't tell you why we hired. Erica Oleniak, at least, you know, we had another. We wanted Danny Baldwin.
Yeah.
Bill and I read Danny Baldwin. We. I just saw a little sign pop up. I'm just talking on and on.
You're fine.
You're good.
We wanted Danny Baldwin. And so. Yeah, Dennis. I think Danny Baldwin would have been. This was never going to be Demon Knight.
Yeah.
It was never going to be that quality. It just wasn't. But Danny Baldwin would have given us, at least would have given the character a little bit of traction.
Yeah.
Erica Oleniak, at least we understood. We had another actress in mind. The problem was that when we hired Erica, she was suddenly rethinking her whole career. She didn't want to be that kind. She wouldn't do those kind of parts. So she makes this decision just after taking the female lead in Bordello of Blood. Okay.
Romantic comedy, you know.
That presented its own problem. She, Erica, look, hey, she's entitled to, you're entitled to do that, but really? We tell the story in the podcast about how we always started shooting on a Thursday. This is something that Gil likes to do as a producer and as a director. And so you get 2 days of shooting under your belt. If you got any big problems, you have the weekend to fix them before you head into the next week.
Yeah.
And so we started you know, a couple of small scenes on Thursday just to get up to speed. I think Corey Feldman worked one of those first days. We were still waiting for Erica Leniak to get on a plane. She worked Tuesday. She had to fly Sunday to be in wardrobe on Monday to work Tuesday. And on Saturday, we're still arguing with her. And her manager is telling me that she just wants to be thought of differently as an actress now. And she doesn't want to play a former porn star. Well, my movie is shooting already. what does he want me to rewrite? But she insists she's not getting on a plane if the character was a former porn star. Oh, well, whole plot points hinge on this. I don't know what you want me to do. And so what we finally agreed to, and you know, to make it even funnier, her manager at that time had been a former porn actor.
Of course.
And so he was very sympathetic, but there was nothing he could do. You know, this is his client. So what we finally agree is that she was a former porn star, but she was heavy.
Yeah.
Instead of going by the name Chesty O'Toole, she went by the name Chubby O'Toole.
Yep.
So she was unrecognizable now because she had lost so much weight. Even hearing it, even discussing it again, really just makes me think, God, that's offensive. It's stupid. It's horrible in a thousand different ways. But I had to get this actress on a plane. And so, yes, I'll do anything. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, we made the deal. Well, then, of course, the rest of the weekend was rewriting the script and all the ripple effects that had throughout it. On Monday, Dennis Miller shows up on the set for the first time. He had arrived, and I handed Dennis the brand new script with all his new lines, and I had to explain to Dennis, look, this script is not written for Dennis. He's a comedian. It's not a terribly funny script. I know this. I know this for a fact. I had 3 weeks to make this the story work.
Yeah.
I don't have time to make this character funny. This character doesn't make any sense to begin with. He's a detective who lives in a small town. How much call do you suppose there is in a small town for a detective?
Yeah.
How's he making a living here? he's a walking, talking contradiction. He doesn't make any sense. How do you build a character? In order to make a character funny, it's got to come from who they are. It can't just be riffing lines. What the fuck is that? That's nothing. You know, to hold a character, a funny character, hold a feature film, they got to be built on something. There's nothing to build on. And so there was no way to write that character funny. And so, yeah, okay. The script that I handed Dennis Miller, it was not funny. Well, his character was not terribly funny. No argument. There was no way to do it. And then I had to explain first, oh, by the way, he's no longer was a former porn addict. He was addicted. His thing was big women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dennis looks at me like, what? And then he flips open the script and he looks at the first line and he points at it and says, I can't say that. And he says, you know, and he closes the script and says, you know, I'm not going to say anything in this script. I'm going to improvise all my own dialogue. And there's not much I can say. It's not like I can say, dude, this is Hamlet. You're going to say every fucking word. I can't say that.
No.
The last goddamn thing in it is Hamlet. So, you know, I'm between a rock and a hard place. And look, you know, as I confessed in the podcast, I was rubbish. I was crap. I was a weak producer. I was a disinterested producer. I didn't give a shit. This was not, if we'd been doing Dead Easy, I'd have fought him tooth and nail. If anyone had said, it would probably have been very, very different.
Yeah.
But here, every weakness I had as an inexperienced feature producer, you know, I'd been making a TV show. I had experience. I did know how to do this.
Yeah.
But every weakness I had suddenly just rushed to the foreground and yeah. So yeah, I said, yeah, okay, sure, Dennis. And that was a disaster.
Yeah.
Because yeah, he improvised all his lines, big pieces of information never made it into the dialogue. When Dennis would work with the other actors, of course he'd improvise all his lines. It didn't necessarily work with what the other actors were saying. And that wasn't fun for them. Dennis was doing his HBO show. They rehearsed on Thursday, shot on Friday. And so in theory, then we couldn't have Dennis 2 days a week. Well, that didn't work for us. So we flipped our week to accommodate Dennis and his show. Jeez. And we made our Monday Saturday. The Saturday was our Monday. And that's not the deal our Canadian crew made. Mm-mm. They're not like us. They don't live to work. They work to live. And
I mean, that's all a million bucks will get you, you know?
had Dennis come in and said to the crew, guys, I apologize for doing this to you. He didn't. He was a total asshole to them. Yeah. And so the crew disliked him. Well, all right. So because he was doing his show, he was tired all the time. And he'd send his assistant to me first thing in the morning. And she said, Dennis is so tired. Can we shoot him out early? And I'd say, yeah, okay. And so that's what we do. We would shoot Dennis's side of a scene with all the actors working with him. And then after lunch, we'd turn around, you have to do a relight. And Dennis would go back to the hotel, sleep. And all the actors would have to work to the script supervisor reading Dennis's improvised lines, which didn't necessarily work with theirs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the other actors quickly became disenchanted with Dennis.
A little bit, yeah. So I wanted to say something since I'm so fortunate to get to have you here. One of the things I really appreciated about your podcast was you talking so honestly about being depressed and talking so honestly about those struggles, because so many people don't. They fight those battles entirely privately, and fair enough, you know, everybody has every right to do those things that way, but it also makes someone else feel like maybe they're the only person who's ever fought that battle when they never hear anybody else talk about it.
Here. I am like, everyone walks their own path, and I can only speak for me. My darkness was my darkness, and everyone's darkness is their own. The thing about depression and darkness, it robs you of all perspective. And you become utterly convinced that the world is this very narrow place and all the other stuff out here, it doesn't exist, it doesn't matter. It's not true.
Yeah.
But that's what it does to you. And whatever you can do to break free from your darkness's hold, because it's lying to you. I was keeping a secret for myself.
Yeah.
For 45 years, when I was 14, I was molested twice by the man who... by the religious director at the synagogue where my family belonged in Northwest Baltimore. I kept that secret from myself for 45 years. I knew it happened. I knew it. And I denied it. I'm denying bad shit that happened to you. It never works out well. Yeah. And part of the reason that 2 decades of writer's block had to do with the secret I was keeping. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly blamed myself for that thing happening to me. I was 14.
Yeah.
The problem is it happened twice. And it happened twice because I didn't say anything the first time.
Yeah.
And so the minute it started to happen the second time, I was done. I'd done this to myself. And so because this one terrible thing was happening to me because of me, everything bad that happened to me afterwards was me. I had a great life. Tales from the Crypt. I had a wonderful and have a wonderful life, but this thing was gnawing at me. It's a cancer.
Yeah.
And it metastasized. Yeah. It was cool, but you know, I lived with it and it was okay. But inside, it was always, it was the thing that never, I had no self-confidence because I lived on an island. Inside my head, I had friends, but none of them really knew me because you didn't know the secret about me.
Right.
Yeah.
But you didn't really know me. You just think you know me, dude. Well, this is a terrible way to live.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
And it wreaks havoc on a creative mind, too. Eventually, at first, it's very easy to turn trauma into great stories. But eventually trauma just is your trauma, and that's all it is.
It consumes you, and mine was consuming me. I'm grateful that that I didn't hurt myself when I tried to, that I stopped at just the last second, but I knew I was quite capable of doing it at that point. Then it was just Oh, you coward. You won't be so lucky next time, dude. And I've been contemplating doing something, but I was desperately afraid of the medication hurting my creativity. And so I'd done a lot. You know, my dad was a surgeon. I grew up in the medical, in the medical world. You know, I knew the culture.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, a GP, the only thing he knew about, you know, a mood stabilizer was, hey, the last pharmaceutical rep who came through the office said, hey, got any depressed patients? Give them some of this. See if that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're going to have on hand. And that's what they're going to hand me. And I didn't want that. I wanted, you know, they're all different. I didn't want to go. I was in a terrible place. I didn't want to go 6 to 8 weeks to see if it was going to help and discover it was worse.
Well, and so, I mean, obviously, you know, you and I, all, we don't know each other. My, my career is, I actually produce and direct very small features, and that's my day job. And, it's a very, very stressful job. I make, you know, films for, you know, used car prices a lot of the times.
Boy. Hey. I'd love to have a whole conversation with you about that world.
Oh man. It is something else, but, I had the same fear that because I have to be incredibly vigilant because I do all of my deals. And then I also do a lot of the creative elements and stuff. I'd be like, oh, I'm really depressed, or oh, I'm really anxious, or oh, I'm really struggling. And Dave's my best friend in the world, so he can be like, oh yeah, I remember when Henrik, before he got on his anxiety medicine, that son of a bitch.
I do.
Dave can tell you all about it. But I remember not even that long ago, I finally said, you know what, I should try this Zoloft thing. But I kept saying, like, well, what if I take the Zoloft and then the magic's gone? And then I realized that by calling the skills and talent and ability I've cultivated my entire life magic, I was discounting myself.
Oh, surely. Oh, you, this has been, I've enjoyed myself immensely, Henrik. You're wonderful. You're exquisite. I'm dying to see your stuff as a director.
Thank you. I have a film. I'm going to send you a link. I think you'll really like, called Nothing Good Ever Happens. It's like my ode to sadness.
I got lucky. Because, you know, I had researched a particular thing, lamotrigine, and it was originally created as for people with epilepsy. It's an anti-seizure medication, and I guess, you know, people on with epilepsy get very depressed too, understandably. Yeah, so
it's not a great time.
It seemed to mitigate some of their depression. So anecdotally, there was evidence that it mitigated depression. What I had read at the point at that point was that, but it wouldn't put a touch on your on my hypomania. I am bipolar and I'm hypomanic. My brain goes a gajillion miles an hour. If you could look inside my head, it's like a black box theater.
Yeah, you know, no, I get that. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and inside there's a laser show. There must be 12, 13 movies being projected, things being projected on the walls. There's music. There's everything you could possibly want, and it's all fantastic. It's fantastic. What I found, the lamotrigine helped because it put the darkness in a box. Oh, I still know it's there. I would never take that bastard for granted ever, but it can't get at me.
Yeah.
The lamotrigine stops the emotions from allowing that to run me. It's really cool.
Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. But no, that's a phenomenal thing. And anybody who's listening to this, if you've ever wondered, would it help?
I got lucky. I bounced. And the lamotrigine work, I also find that for me, and I can only speak for me, I use a great deal of cannabis.
In California.
First thing in the morning to last thing at night.
But
I find that the THC works wonderfully on my hypomania.
Mm-hmm. I believe that, for sure.
It slows it down. So instead of a dozen and a half things going on, suddenly there are three or four that I can focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I understand that
and
too.
That is, so the combination of the lamotrigine keeps the darkness at bay, the cannabis really slows everything down, and I've got a wonderful therapist who saw me through the darkest of days. And yeah, I bounced. I'm
good.
I consider myself lucky beyond words. I bounced and I began to live because, well, once I was able to deal with the darkness, I could finally address my secret. And it was the weekend when I addressed my secret, when I finally admitted to myself that this terrible thing happened, you got to own it. It was the hardest weekend I've ever gone through.
Sure.
Yeah.
I lay on the bathroom floor just weeping. for the 14-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was cathartic. And I walked out the other side of that. Oh, man. I walk around in a perpetual state of bliss. It ain't the Lamotrigine. It ain't the cannabis just slows me down. I'm not interested in being high. I got so much work I got to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the therapy just allowed me to gain perspective.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is possible to come out the other side of the darkness and be, it's the word that matters more than anything, happy.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you share that story because it really is important. People who share their stories really have helped me keep myself right too. Yeah. You know, are you familiar with Fred Decker? He wrote Monster Squads. Oh yeah, and he worked on Tales and everything. Yeah. And then let's get to Kevin Bacon real quick. But Fred Decker did a great interview once where he mentioned that after RoboCop 3, he just didn't have much success for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And then after that, he was like, wait a second. Have I been completely and utterly life-destroyingly depressed for 5 years straight? And it turned out, yes, he had been completely, but he didn't even know when it was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew I was depressed. I didn't realize that it was a writer's block. I was writing stuff, but I was writing stuff for other people.
Yeah.
I did not an original idea in my head. I occasionally would partner with other people and they would have the idea and then I would go, okay, and we could do this, we could do that. Cause you know, it's improv. It's yes. And I understand improv, but nothing came from me.
Yeah.
I had no stories to tell. And the least interesting story of all was my own. And that's really what doing the podcast was such a healthy thing to do because it was me going, I need to tell my story. Yeah, just to get this off my chest. The crazy thing was, I wasn't the only person who made Bordello of Blood that needed that catharsis.
Yeah,
sure.
It turned out all of us felt exactly the same way about making that movie. It was antithetical to our every one of our creative processes.
So
it was the uncrypt.
Yeah. I cannot recommend again enough. If you haven't listened to How Not to Make a Movie, please do. One of my favorite parts about the first season, and like Dave has been very quiet. That is because Dave had a wonderful childhood. His parents are still married. They had money. So so that's why Dave's so quiet.
Dave's elite. Dave's elite.
I ought to hit him. But no, it's a great show. And one of the reasons I loved it so much was that you can hear the gleefulness of the storytelling for you.
Yeah.
Because you're a storyteller. And I identify with that very, very much because I love telling stories and not just, you know, on a podcast or on a movie. I mean, catch me in a long Christmas line at the post office and I will chat and listen and laugh. I enjoy that human thing so much. I wanted to ask you just a few questions about when you first heard Gil was hooked up with this Freddy's Nightmare show, right? What was it like? Because Freddy was becoming massive.
Yeah, because at that point, part four was out. So, yeah.
Yeah, we were, it's funny, they had just, which is, they started turning funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that was something that we really loved on the show because we, you know, that was, it's really hard to maintain horror.
Yeah. Every single week.
It really is because it just is.
Yeah.
So, what was the question?
Oh, well, no, it was just kind of, were you like, whoa, because this was becoming like the big horror IP, or were you just kind of like, all right, let's put our boots on. It's another gig.
You know, the brand was expanding and getting bigger.
Yeah.
And so we were part of this larger enterprise, the Freddy's business.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Gil and I went to the feature set one day who directed, oh God, I'm going up on his name. Rennie Harlan.
Yes.
Yeah. Part four. Yep.
Yeah. We went to visit Rennie on the set. I think for some reason, you know, so we were connected to the features too. We weren't strangers. You know, working with Robert was fun. The, you know, those wraparounds were
something else.
It gets so wild so quickly. Yeah.
Writing the Crypt Keeper was more.
Oh yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
sure.
I can imagine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and Freddie was more on the show so far. We've noticed is more focused around gags and not just great writing. I mean, you know, he would say something, but he'd also have a bouket of flowers burst into flames and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He was all about like that.
He was more of a clown in that way.
It was, you know, to make him, you know, really work as it was before the Crypt Keeper, but as a Crypt Keeper, you know, that's a very tricky thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where Tales from the Crypt is concerned, they've tried to remake that a couple times.
Yeah.
Most recently, M. Night Shyamalan had optioned the rights to the EC Comics.
Yeah.
And after he'd gotten the rights to the EC Comics, I was called into a meeting to try to help him.
Oh wow.
Figure out what to do with it. He didn't realize he didn't have the Crypt Keeper.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
The Crypt Keeper in the EC Comics is a white dude with stringy hair.
I just watched the 72 version, the Amicus film, a couple nights ago.
Oh well, yeah, it's Ralph Richardson.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah, well, Ralph Richardson, okay, that's a fancier version of what's in the comic book. But it's just a guy. It's just a guy.
Yeah.
The Crypt Keeper was created, let's put it this way, he's a separate piece of IP.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, yeah.
And that was created by Kevin.
Yep.
Kevin Yeager. And then that was the puppet. But then they had to find a voice. And in season two, episode one of our podcast, we did a collective interview of me, Kevin Yeager, John Kassir, and Gil talking about the creation of the Crypt Keeper.
Yeah.
Because all four of us really are responsible for creating that character. Ironically, not one of us owns a piece of him. Not one teeny bit. Joel owns every bit of it.
Of course.
But, you know, Kevin tells the story of auditioning John Kassir to be the voice of the Crypt Keeper. And there had been a couple of real big actors had come in and were quite certain that they had scored that gig. But it wasn't until John came in and it was really the laugh. You know, there was just a certain unhinged quality to what John did. And it was the laugh. And John tells the very funny story. The laugh was, you know, John's not a stand-up, but he kind of got hooked in as a stand-up. He did a stand-up competition.
Yeah.
And when he came up with a couple of bits, one of the bits was The Wizard of Oz in 90 seconds. And this is the Crypt Keeper's laugh is his Wicked Witch of the West laugh.
Yeah, I remember him saying that. Up.
He repurposed his Wicked Witch of the West laugh as the Crypt Keeper's laugh. Which is, it's funny, that reminds me, there's a, oh God, I'm going to go, oh yes. The Homer Simpson dough is based on, what is it, Joey Brown? It's based on, he's got a really funny story of where that sound came from. It was an old movie guy who just loved the sound. I think when Joey Brown, I think and so it's just funny sometimes where the Crypt Keeper's laugh. I mean, geez, it's iconic now.
Yeah,
absolutely 100%. It is.
Come Halloween, if you don't hear the Crypt Keeper's laugh, it ain't Halloween.
Halloween, Christmas. Dave and I are major fans, unironically, of the Tales from the Crypt Christmas album. So,
oh my God, I don't know if they even have it anymore.
Oh man, oh no,
they should re-release that. There's money.
They really should.
But Joel's,
yeah. Yeah, well, you know, but Well, before we wrap up here today, first of all, I just want to say humongous thank you for sitting down with us and chatting.
Thank you so much.
It's been so exciting to just get to chat a little bit.
Really and truly, let's do it again, please.
I would love to. Yeah, we'll get a hold of you after we get a little further into season two and we get to some more episodes you worked on.
I don't wear out my welcome.
No, but we would love it, sincerely. And if you think of anybody in that realm that, you know, got a chance to work on Freddy's Nightmares or something that would want to talk to us, please let us know. We'd love to talk to them.
Yeah. Break the vow of silence.
I it's funny. It's a show that most people don't even know it even exists.
Yeah.
Well, it was so hard to get after syndication ended. Yeah. You just couldn't find it anywhere.
There's a single VHSs that had like one or two episodes on them.
Which I found one at Value City Department Store in Dayton, Ohio when I was 14 years old. I found the tape. Like, that's how like elusive it was. And I was a Freddy fanatic when I was a teenager. And even I was like, wait, TV show? What?
So, yeah.
And now that it's on Tubi.
A secret from everybody.
I know. And now that it's on Tubi, people are finally getting to rediscover it, and I'm having a lot of people.
Yeah. Screambox had it for a couple months, or it might have been a little longer than that, and then Tubi picked it up right at like the beginning of summer, I want to say.
So now a lot of Fred heads are talking about it, and now they're joining us on this show where we're talking about it with them, because we're all nerds who are getting more Freddy after we thought we were way done getting more Freddy.
Oh no, there's And it's odd Freddy too.
That's the best part. That's the best part. I mean, we just finished the episode where he starts scratching the DJ.
Rapmaster DJ Freddy.
It's so fun.
Those were the days.
Oh man. Well, and that's the other thing that's great about it, is it really felt like y'all were just having fun.
Yeah.
You were getting to take that Freddy Krueger-ness, and you guys were making some weird, creepy, sometimes some of them were legitimately kind of scary too. I mean, they weren't all stupid or silly. They accomplished a lot, and you guys got to just play in that, like you were saying, like a sandbox. You got to play in that Springwood sandbox while simultaneously building it out, because the movies barely gave much of that world. So in fact, I wanted to say the most exciting thing about the episode about Freddy's Tricks and Treats for me was getting to see Freddy on Halloween, because that's like, as a kid, it's like, what does Freddy do on Halloween? I mean, you know, you hope he's not trick or treating.
I can hope.
Yeah. But thank you again so much. Please, everybody, if you haven't listened yet, How Not to Make a Movie Podcast. I know we keep plugging it, but I plug it because sincerely, I enjoyed it. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if we hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
I mean that, because that was what gave us the push of like, shoot, we really do need to sit down and watch every Freddy's Nightmares.
Yeah, exactly.
So it served a purpose.
Exactly.
I will also point out while we're here that Entertainment Weekly has called our podcast the best film podcast of 2022.
Wow.
That's awesome. Congrats. Yeah,
excellent.
Clark Collis, their writer, did an interview with us, and he put that right in the headline that we were the best film podcast of 2022.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Really nice. And thank you, Clark. Really generous of you, man.
It's well earned. So thank you again, my friend. I'm going to hit the thing. A huge thank you to Alan Katz for being on our show. One of hopefully many, many great interviews we're going to do all about the making of Freddy's Nightmares. If you enjoy what you're hearing, make sure you're subscribed, and why not leave us a star rating? And if you want to reach out and cut someone at the show, send us an email at freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with a more standard episode where we break down yet another piece of Springwood horror. But for now, my friends, see you next week.